Being recorded.
Okay, Glenn, would you like to take a roll call?
Yes, certainly. On the call, we have Ray Fassett, Ron Andruff, Wolf Ulrich Knoben, Avery Doria, and we have regret from Robin Gross. For staff, we have Julie Headland and myself, Glenda Saint-Jury. Thank you, Ray.
Okay, thank you, Glenn. All right, so we're going to hit the ground running on the rules of procedure document today. We left off on section, we were completed through section 5.1 at the last call. I have some edits or nits on some additional sections that I don't think will take us much time to go through. These are already highlighted in the document, and I foresee us today spending the bulk of our time on section 4.1 and section 16 and a new, potentially new, section 17 that speaks to email voting. So with that said, I would like to ask if there's any other sections besides the ones I've identified with some minor edits that anyone would like to discuss between 5.2 and 17, section, or the new section 18. Anything? If not, I would like to go right into 5.2, and I think everybody can see what I proposed as edits. Not that the language is exactly right, but just the, you know, the concepts behind it. Can everybody see those edits? Mine show up in green.
Well, I didn't have the chance to read it right now, but I look at it, yes.
This is notice of meetings?
Yeah, 5.2,
okay,
notice
yeah.
of meetings.
Yeah, mine are in purple.
Oh, yours are in purple. Okay. So, again, minor things. There was a part put in there that had to do with also posting the notice of meetings to Social Text Workspace. And the only issue I had there was you may not be using Social Text Workspace in the future, so try to make that more generic, which is why there's a last line now that says advance notice shall also be posted to other council workspaces where practical, something like that.
I think that makes sense. I think, but I would just, you know, it's a very small matter. The work and spaces would be a lowercase, I think, in that case.
Yeah, good point. Yeah.
Otherwise, that looks like it's determining some specific thing.
Yeah, good
great.
Point.
This is Julie. I've noted that. I make that change.
Great. And then in the very next paragraph, it says something about all reports or proposed declarations, and I just didn't understand what that meant. What is a declaration?
Avery? You
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I mean, the things that get posted are motions.
Yeah.
But those are usually 7 days in advance, although if you guys want to move it to 14, I think there's a lot of people that would appreciate that from one extent as they have more time to think about it. From the other extent, though, getting them done 14 days in advance will harry people. But we have motions, and I guess that's about it. I mean, there's also statement of interest updates, but those can happen at any time, including during the meeting. So,
this is Ron Avery. Does a council member propose a motion to the council?
Yep.
They do? They come and say, oh, well, we've got something we want to talk about. We're proposing a motion for the next meeting?
No, not that.
Doesn't
that, would
that
be
come
a,
about as a result of a...
Right, that would be an agenda item. And certainly, you know, council members do suggest agenda items. What I do now is certainly send out a email. I mean, first of all, Chuck and I and Glenn talk about it, and there's a certain number of things that go on the agenda. Then I'll get in touch with all of the council members that are acting as liaisons to a work group and ask if there's anything that needs to be on the agenda. I'll also ask, you know, the staff members that are working with the various groups, is there anything that needs to be on the agenda? Then a draft agenda goes up asking, you know, the membership, you know, here's the agenda. Is there anything that needs to be added? And then, you know, I'll update it through the week before the meeting as needed. And then we basically do a quick review of the agenda at the beginning of the meeting and then proceed on that agenda. And the draft agenda has to be up at least 7 days before the meeting at the moment. But that's sort of the process I've been following.
Well, that being the case, then I would make a recommendation that we change that to reports, and we can just say reports should be submitted, or we can put reports and motions. But the word declaration, I agree. I think this is old language that came from a long time ago, because the only declarations that I ever hear of are when the GAC makes a declaration at the end of their, they used to read that report, and often it was a declaration. But that was the only thing that I've ever heard as a declaration.
Yeah, what do you think is referred to by reports?
Oh, it's anything that's to be discussed during the meeting. For example, you know, if a report comes out of a working group, or you know, if the staff is doing an issues report or something like that to get on the agenda, just like motions, they at this point have to be postable 7 days in advance.
Okay, so I think maybe I like the idea Ron has, just having it reports and motions should be submitted.
Yes. Yeah.
And changing it in the latter half of the sentence as well.
Yeah,
okay.
This is Julie. I've made that change.
Okay, and then the third paragraph, all I did was just in any given year, it just makes sense to me. So just say the time of the meetings may vary to accommodate the different geographic regions.
Agreed.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right.
You might want to change that may to should.
The time of the meetings may vary. May vary to accommodate.
Okay,
I'm just. I mean, with people around the world.
Yeah. Well, what do others think?
Oh, I think let's leave it ambiguous.
Okay.
All right. So, okay, my next one is 5.4. I just have a question there under council initiation. What does that mean? What is that?
It should be initiation of a PDP. That's what I understand. Nothing else.
Certainly, Annex A is the PDP process.
Well, then that's what you say, council initiation of a PDP. And actually spell PDP out.
Right.
Council
now,
initiation
policy
of a
development process.
Okay. On this one, there is this whole ambiguity. And I think the PDP working group is probably working on it, or working team is working on it, is there's requesting an issues report and all the ways in which that happens, which in some sense is the first part of the PDP process.
Yeah.
But you actually don't start a PDP until after the issues report and you vote to do a PDP or not. So in picking this, you might want to pick a word, you know. So initiating the PDP process may actually be the way you want to say it, as opposed to starting a PDP.
Uh-huh. Yes. Wait, it's Rob speaking. So that's what I understand from this group as well. And so far as I understand the PDP process right now, is at first then the initiation of a PDP process. That's right. But why not? You know, you could read from this paragraph that the issues report may have been delivered already.
Well, maybe you can say that upon receipt of an issues report.
Both issues reports and initiating the PDP have their own defined thresholds.
Okay.
And there's three different thresholds. One for initiating requesting the issues report if it's done by the council, and then one to initiate a PDP if it's declared in scope, and one for initiating a PDP if it's declared out of scope.
Okay, well, let me take one step back. What is this sentence, council initiation, what's it even doing under this 5.4?
This is Julie Ray. That's where it was before.
But what is it supposed to, what are we trying to achieve here, considering that the title is the number of votes cast?
Yeah, I'm thinking we just delete it.
Or you just say policy development process defined in. It's a bylaws thing, so you just make a reference to it.
But again, I'm kind of following Ray's lead on this one. I, I'm not sure whether PDP would fit under the heading of number of votes cast. Is there some logic for that?
Yeah.
Below that? No.
Yeah, I think.
Well, this is Julie. Actually, I think the logic was that the number of votes cast has varying thresholds. I think, as Avery just mentioned, depending on, you know, the various processes. The way it's difficult here because the way it read before, all of the language that is now currently wrapped up in Annex A, the policy development process, was here. And so you had this sentence that said, to pass a motion, must attain a majority of the votes cast, at blah, 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 and then, you know, except in the following cases, and then it listed each case, council initiation, this is, you know, this was, you know, the process, vote of the council, this was the process, and so on. But since we're not duplicating the language that's in the bylaws with respect to the PDP, and because, you know, that working team is still working on that language, we're simply referencing. So I agree, it's confusing. It's just that when you're talking about numbers of votes cast, it varies, thresholds vary depending on the process, as I understand it. And Avery, please correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, that just brought home something clear, some clarity to me in this. Maybe those that whole section of each one of those bullets, council initiation, vote of council, task force, council report, agreement of council, should just be at least is set in a little bit so you recognize that that's a list. Because until you just said that, Julie, I didn't catch that. I didn't catch the colon at the end of the following cases. So that might clarify that. And in that case, we could make this council initiation of a policy development process.
I don't know if council can initiate a policy development process.
Yeah.
They can or can... Yeah, they can or... Yeah, that's
who else?
Issue.
Yeah. I mean, basically... Okay, it depends on how we're... First of all, policy development process, and I know I said it myself, is actually redundant. Because it's a policy development process, so PDP process. But anyway, and the wording is really confused. There are many ways to request an issues report. Board, advisory committee, or council. If board requests it, then after the issues report, the PDP starts automatically. I've never quite understood what would happen if the board requested it and it was out of scope. I think it would still have to happen. If an AC requests it or the council requests it, then the council takes a vote on initiating the PDP itself.
After the issues report.
After the issues report, right. So almost anybody can ask for an issues report. The GNSO has something to say about, you know, what happens if an AC requests it, but has nothing to say if the board were to request it. But the GNSO definitely initiates PDPs.
Well, okay, yes, the process of a PDP. I got you.
And the PDP itself.
However,
as I say, I haven't been paying attention to the PDP work team, so I don't know if they've been good to us and define some better terminology. And probably we should check on that.
I agree with what Avery said, but I think for the purpose of this document and the purpose of this work team,
yeah,
I would, for my part, I would be happy if that said council initiation of a policy development process and then CICAN bylaws annex, and then just continue to have that list as it is, but make it more list-like as opposed to paragraph by paragraph.
Would you number it? 1, 2, 3,
no,
4?
No, I wouldn't number it. I would just indent it, you know, like, you know, two spaces for each one so that, you know, it shows it's clearly a list.
Okay, after the colon.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess I'm okay with that. Anybody else? So it would read council initiation of a policy development process. And it refers to the bylaws, and then we indent and make it better understood that it's part of...
I have one other question, though, Chair.
Yeah,
and this thing about abstentions count as votes cast.
Yeah, we talked about that one, although it's, you know, we can bring it up again. It's
where did we... Just for clarity, I'm sorry to bring it back again, but I I always thought abstention was a lost vote.
Yeah, it neutral.
Didn't fall exactly. Didn't fall for. Didn't fall against.
Yeah. Apparently the board is. Apparently that's what the board follows. Right? Is that correct? The board follows that an abstention votes as a count against.
Right. An abstention is a non-vote. Is not a vote for. And since everything is seen in votes for, you know, but yeah, it's just a different way of doing a negative vote.
Okay. Well, if that's already carved in stone, then that's fine.
Well, nothing is carved in stone.
Well, I mean it from the point of view that it's already being widely used within the organization. We don't
and basically,
that.
I mean, there's actually, I should probably bring it up because this is something that is done in practice that is probably slightly different than the letter of the law. In practice, abstentions on PDPs were for essentially conflict of interest reasons. And one had to basically give their conflict of interest reason for abstaining. It has evolved to the point where you can abstain any time, and you can use the fact that you're abstaining to be able to put a statement into the record. So sometimes people will now abstain as opposed to voting against because you can make a statement against that gets put in the record. And that's something that has become practice, and I certainly haven't wanted to change practice. But, you know, it isn't codified anywhere, and you guys should just know about it.
But right now in practice, the board does count an abstention as a vote against, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks for that background, though. Very helpful.
Yeah.
Well, I'm fine with it as discussed personally, and also in the next paragraph where you've included working groups and work team reports. So from my side, the 5.4 is good to go.
Ray, this is Julie. I've noted the changes. It now reads council initiation of a policy development process, and I've indented that section.
Okay.
Thank you.
I suspect we may get questions on that from the OSC, but we'll deal with that then. 5.5 is my next one. We've deleted the very first paragraph that speaks to transmit meetings of its minutes to the ICANN secretary. There's no need to do that. Now, down and below, again, just some nits, I think. One, two, three, fourth paragraph down. If agreement is not achieved, the chair will determine the final version of the minutes and will note areas in which agreement has not been achieved, rather than may. I think they should note that.
Agreed.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the next two, you'll see two, the word formal, I took the word out. Why? Because I think we discussed that if...
Ray, I'm sorry, this is
yeah,
Julie, if
yes.
I can interrupt. As I see it right now, we have within and we have a blank number of days of a GNSO calendar.
Oh, yeah, I missed that one. I put that back in. Wolf had an issue with that one. He thought that we really should put a number of days in and we really went back and forth on it, and so I just wanted to bring it back up again. I don't think it's a bad idea. You know,
I think in a document like this, you know, it's always better to have timelines.
Yeah. So that's why I put those brackets back in there. I wanted to hear the group again if they had if they want to just put in a placeholder number of days, 5 days, 7 days.
Well, I would go back to Avery again. What's realistic, Avery, in terms of, you know, real people's time schedules being able to bang this thing out after a call?
I think giving the secretariat 5 days, 5 business days to get it out, and then since you're going to have a 14-day, first of all, you're setting the meetings at a month. You're going to have a 14-day. Everything's got to be on the record before the meeting. I think if those minutes, if you back schedule it from they have to be available 14 days, you've basically got two sets of 5 working days. So I'd say 5 working days, not because we can't assume, you know, 5 working days for the secretary to get the first draft out. and 5 working days for, you know, everything to be worked out. And that means that those meetings are available 14 days, you know, and you can even put in a phrase, to be available 2 weeks before the next meeting. And Glenn, you should speak up if what I said doesn't make sense to you.
Yes, yes, it does, Avery.
Yeah, now the issue Ken raised on this is, you know, a meeting in, pick Seoul, okay, and it's on a Wednesday, and there's travel back from that meeting, and, you know, it may not, you know, it might be difficult, you know, due to travel to meet the day threshold, 5 days or whatever.
5 working days, yeah.
Five business days.
But if we're a couple of 5 business days, I don't have a problem putting that in.
There, you know, there may be exceptions when people travel.
Yeah.
You know, you may want to put in a statement that says, you know, this requirement may be relaxed, you know, after a face-to-face meeting if necessary, but, you know.
Well, I think actually, Avi, once the OSC has approved this, then it goes to the new council. The new council really have to go back and review all of this stuff and make sure that they're happy and clear on it, and then the council itself could make a modification at that point, could they not?
Oh, I assume so.
Yeah, I do too. What I'm getting at is rather than clutter, put a kind of a kind of a backdoor on this number of days in there, I think there's a backdoor on pretty well all of this in terms of, you know, potential modification that comes to it. So I would be reluctant to add another sentence in there.
And no one's going to get in trouble. I just know that, you know, often Glenn does take a vacation right after, you know, if we go to somewhere far off, and so therefore, you know.
Well, why don't we go seven business days then? At least that will provide effectively.
And this is going to happen this time again after Seoul, so I'm warning you.
Yeah, no, that's fair. So why don't we say well, make it eight business days. Then it provides for basically a week and a half of time.
Okay. That's good for now?
Sure.
All right, let me just put a footnote in there. Glenn said it was okay.
Yeah, exactly. A little asterisk.
Yeah. All right.
Approved by the Secretariat.
All right, so down below then, Julie, if you could put that in. And then down below, I just took out the word formal and formally, and the reason is I think we decided that there's no one says anything against the minutes, where it's just going to be taken as approved, right? So there is no, there may not be a formal approval of the minutes, but instead a default approval of the minutes, if you will. So I just took out the word formal.
Yeah,
agreed.
Okay, so... my next one is what, 5-7?
5-6 or something.
Oh, yeah, 5-6. Right, 5-6. Thanks, Wolf. I didn't get that one sentence in there. It's points of information and normal interventions. I'm thinking it might be a heading.
It seems to be, yes.
That's how I saw it, too.
So we should have maybe two headings. The one is point of order, and the second one is point of information and normal interventions or so. You know, if the first two sentences, at a physical meeting, a genus or council member may raise a hand and so on, that's referring to point of order.
Right.
And then the next ones are referring to the points of information. So it's just editorial. Maybe we put two headings in it.
Yeah, I think that makes sense, Wolf. So you're saying at the beginning of this paragraph begins at a physical meeting, so right above that you would put point of order? As
yes.
A subheading, and then you would pick up where points of information and normal interventions. Point of information would be the second one where it effectively is now, and then the sentence begins that underneath that rubric, at a physical meeting, a genus of council may raise a hand.
Yeah.
I have a question here. We're not. How are we defining point of order? Are we defining it as Roberts does, and do we need to put that definition in? So the point of order is basically supposed to be given if somebody does something bad during the meeting or says something evil, and you right after they do it, you're supposed to raise the point of order. And how do we define point of order?
You
and
mentioned
we need to
I
know
have
what
Roberts.
They are.
What's the Roberts definition, Aubrey?
Okay.
Ray?
Yes.
Yeah, it's Ken Stubbs.
Hey, welcome, Ken.
Well, thank you. I've just been a fly on the wall here. I have a suggestion. is there anything wrong with us using the Robert's Rules of Order as a reference? In other words, if a specific issue that would normally, that might pop up, and if we don't have a specific action defined, the default, in effect, would be the Robert's Rules of Order. Is it too complicated? Have we violated it that many times in the other parts of the council operations?
I don't think you've violated it in this, what's written. Certainly there's a lot of common process that violates it. For example, the whole notion of friendly amendment is completely barred in Robert's Rules of Order. And when I tried to bring that up at the beginning of my term as chair, I quickly learned that this is not something I was going to do anything about.
Right. I was just trying to say that if we had a reference, if we had an issue that was not covered in the bylaws, we could, or was not covered in the operating procedures, then we could have a default go-to that would help resolve some of these issues. That's the point I'm making. I understand what you're saying, but the friendly amendment is specific. The procedure for a friendly amendment is specifically covered under the operations, whereas here's an example where, you know, it would not be, unless we are going to cover every specific thing that could ever happen in a meeting, you know.
Could you say something to the effect of best efforts by council members to abide by Robert's Rules, something like that?
Well, I was asking earlier about the Robert's Rules themselves. That's standard business practice, I'm assuming. The question is there something we can point to that is carved in stone and easy to reference?
Robert's Rules is the standard, but I warn you, anybody who really knows Robert's Rules can totally take down a meeting, especially a meeting of people who don't know them backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
With Robert's Rules in hand, and I've been in groups that where knowing it backwards and forwards was a necessity, with Robert's Rules of Orders in hand, you can dominate a meeting I'm not saying you shouldn't, I'm just saying, you know, someone who knows it can wield it like a very sharp knife.
Well, maybe we could develop some sort of a procedure where if there was an issue, we'd have the right to refer to Robert's Rule of Order on a majority vote of the council or something like that. What I'm trying to think of is issues. I'll give you an example. Years ago, I'll never forget when I was chair of the council, and I can't remember the fellow's name from EuroISPA, but in the middle of the final votes for expansion in the namespace, he got up and made a motion that was just so wacky. You know, we sat there for the next 10 minutes looking at each other, refusing to even acknowledge his motion because nobody knew what to do. Louis was out of the room, and we didn't have any, you know, no one was willing to step up, including myself, and say, well, it's out of order, because I couldn't tell whether it was out of order or not. And I'm just thinking that, you know, unfortunately, these things come up in very, very unusual circumstances. And I think, you know, the last meeting, Phillips Steele, is a perfect example of some crazy things that pop up. You know, I think we should have some sort of authority to refer to if the body agrees to use that authority. That's all I'm looking at, trying to do. Maybe it's too complex and we just wing it, but, you know.
As I say, I'm comfortable with it. I won't be chairing. I'm comfortable with it. I've always had, you know, Rob, a copy of it in my study fairly near my desk, but, yeah.
The only other option would be that you could do it the other way around. You could say that the default is Robert's Rules of Order unless a majority of the council agrees that it would not be used for a specific meeting or a specific deal. Then if you had a crazy situation like that, in effect, the council could say, you know, we can't deal with it. I don't know. Maybe I'm just not trying to throw something into the gears. I'm just trying to figure out how you deal with these.
Well, it's Wolf speaking, so I have a question. I'm not familiar with those kind of rules. You call it Robert's rules, or what else it is?
It's a book. Basically, I think it was actually in the last century. No, two.
Okay, I assume that. But so since I'm not the only one.
Right.
Yeah.
And, I mean,
they're available
on the web.
Really
but
like,
also.
I wouldn't really like to overload these council rules of procedure with some statement for. Strange statement, let me say. For me, it's really strange. So, and then I have to read a book before I can make a point of order or so, these things. So from my understanding, I understood the point of order is something which somebody of a council member raises in case there is something, the decision is going not along these council rules of procedures. That's what I understood. So maybe that's really different, and that's really not the case. But I really am thinking, okay, the council has some rules of procedures, and if there's something wrong with that, if one council member doesn't feel really convenient with that because somebody makes something else, not along those rules, then he can raise a point of order. That was my understanding. Is that totally wrong?
Well, that's I think that is the default assumption, Wolf, and then there's the scenario where people use it differently.
Right. It's basically, in general, you're right. It's if the rules were broken.
Yeah,
if the rules are
really
broken, you can interrupt the debate.
Is that Eric I hear?
No, this was Oliver.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Oh, Eric came
Eric's in the background there, too. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm wasn't even sure if I was muted or not. Robert's Rules of Order comes out of the middle of the 19th century in the United States, and it really is American-specific. So, as Wolf points out, he and others similarly situated will be something at a parliamentary disadvantage by using that particular reference.
Well, just real quick, I don't want to spend too much more time on this, but to Wolf's point, could we say a sentence that says a point of order must refer to an aspect of the rules of procedure?
Right. This is Julie Hedlund. Could I make a suggestion?
Yeah.
Along those lines, I'm looking at the rules of order, but if we don't want to reference them, then my suggestion would be, along the lines of what you're just stating, is to simply define here in the operating procedures what we think is a point of order. In Roberts, it is an infraction of the rules or improper decorum in speaking must be raised immediately after the error is made. Or we could say an infraction of the operating rules of procedure, meaning referencing these rules, or improper decorum in speaking and so on. We could simply embed that definition or whatever definition we like. The same could apply for point of information in the rules of order that generally applies to information desired from the speaker, as in, I should like to ask the speaker a question. We could simply include whatever definition we feel is appropriate for a point of information.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I was suggesting, that we embed the definition.
Yeah, so for a point of order, we would embed the definition to mean specifically a point of order as it refers to the rules of procedure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there could still be some ambiguity there. It's the next sentence. The chair will suspend discussion. We could be flexible there. The chair may suspend discussion.
Well, that's pretty much the way it is, and mostly the chair rules.
Yeah,
whether a point of order is in order or not.
Yeah.
Now, of course, what I did with Philip is I had to turn over the chair since the infraction referred against me. But someone has to rule on whether it's in order or not. It was essentially ruled on as in order because it was then discussed. He could have decided that it wasn't in order, but that would have been a mess anyway. So he did the right thing. But, yes, the chair then says, nope, that wasn't a rule of order, it's not sustained, it's overruled, or they can sustain it.
Yeah, so should we change the word will to may?
I would be inclined to leave it at will, because I think it's important that there are very specific instructions, and it shouldn't be up to one individual to make that choice, or not, notwithstanding that individual is the chair. I think the chair needs to be bound as well if someone calls out a point of order.
Okay, yeah.
Right, yeah. I mean, the chair is bound to let the point of order be spoken. Mm-hmm. Whether then they do something about it or not is...
Okay, yeah, suspend discussion to hear the point. Okay,
right, you have
yeah,
to,
that makes
somebody
sense.
Somebody says point of order, you have to let them speak.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so why don't we just do what Julie suggested, a point of order, and just do the best we can to specifically identify it as needing to pertain to the rules of procedure, which is kind of Wolf's point, too. All right, I don't have the exact language here. Do we want to spend time on now trying to draft that exact language? Or?
Hey, this is Julie. I've put something in if you want. I say a point of order is raised, well, immediately, I'm sorry, following the first sentence, at a physical meeting, et cetera, GNFO council member mm-hmm. may speak over dialogue and say immediately point of order. A point of order is raised when there is an infraction of the GNFO council operating rules of procedure or improper decorum in speaking.
What does improper decorum speaking mean?
Start cursing people out.
Yeah, I think that's standard text, and I think that's a good short and sweet definition. Julie.
And a following sentence could read: "This must be raised immediately after the error is made." Meaning you can't, you know, go on
yeah.
and the discussion go and then say,
right.
"Oh, I wanted to make a point of order," you know, 10 minutes ago.
Right. Rather than this, it would be the point of order must be raised.
Yeah.
Immediately.
So that sounds good.
Yep.
Okay, so carrying that same, we're all comfortable with that. Carrying that same logic now into point of information, the language would be similar, right?
Well, no. Point of information is a different story. Point of information is just engaging in the dialogue that is taking place at that time. So I think the language that is here is fine.
Okay.
This is Julie. I think that a point of information for Robert's Rules of Order just says generally applies to information desired from the speaker, meaning I would like to ask the speaker a question, which is really what's described here, I think.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that we generally do follow.
Yeah. Okay. Are we comfortable with 5.6 now?
I have one small remark.
Yes, Eric.
The by way of guidance for the chair sentence about the 3-minute limit, I'd like that not to be construed as limiting the council from substantive discussion of an issue. So I would simply add, this guidance should not be construed as limiting the council from substantive discussion of an issue.
You want to add that sentence, Eric, after that sentence, the current sentence there, so
yeah.
it finishes with the same speaker on any one issue?
Yeah.
And then you want to add that sentence in there. Would you mind repeating it again?
This guidance should not be construed as limiting the council from substantive discussion of an issue.
And then it picks up, such discretion should not be exercised for a point of information.
Yeah.
This is Julie. I've noted that if others agree.
I think it sounds fine from my side.
Mm-hmm. No.
Okay.
Accepted.
All right. I might have to relook at that one, but I'm okay with it if you guys are comfortable. Okay. Moving on to 5.7. Are we able to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All I did there was delete the second sentence. It just didn't seem necessary to me.
Yeah. Agreed. Outdated.
Yeah. Okay. So then I move all the way to number 7, which is, to me, just that same theme. Add to wherever task forces is, put in working groups and work teams.
Sorry, where'd you jump to?
Yeah, we're
section,
on 5.7.
No, 7. I'm moving all the way to 7.
Oh, point number 7? So,
yeah.
So all the rest, 5.8, we're satisfied with your
call? Oh,
I'm
sorry. If we want to do, okay, let's talk about 5.8. I was going to double back to 5.8.
Well, whatever you like, Chair.
Yeah, no, Yeah, let's double back to 5.8. I just want to finish up the 7 and 8 real quick. 7, all I did was add a reference to working groups and work teams. Section 7.
Agreed.
Okay, and then on Section 8, same thing. Just adding, instead of just saying just task forces, adding working groups and work teams.
Very good.
Now with that, if we're okay, we can go all the way back now to 5.8.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Ray, this is Julie. I just wanted to note that I did add in as a note your suggested language as to why we were not addressing proxies at this point in the process. I'm not sure if that's the appropriate place for it, but right now I've stuck it as a placeholder after 5.8 proxies.
Yeah. That's the language I drafted, whether it's the exact right language. The purpose is to just capture the spirit that, one, the work team, you know, I think everybody recognizes, including outside of our work team, that the work team's work is going to continue even after the SOL meeting. So all we're pointing out to here is that it's not reasonable to expect that the proxy voting is going to be completed in time for SOL. So we'll just keep working on that. Now, that section pertains to 5.8, 5.81, 5.82, 5.8.2.1, 5.83, 8.4, 8.5, everything but 5.8. So when we put in the sentence, the note sentence, note due to the fact, language and the rules, procedure, blah, 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 that has to cover everything except 5.88. That makes sense?
Yeah, I'm just going through it, but I'm just wondering, what is the issue on proxies that we are stuck with that we cannot resolve for a month?
Yeah, my understanding on that is the last time the issue of proxy voting was brought out, not that long ago, it took 18 months just until finally getting, I think, council. I can't stay up council review, and then after all that, it wasn't even accepted. That's the quick history that's been brought to my attention. I did not follow that at all, but that's what it was brought to my attention. Maybe Aubrey knows or others know.
There were lots of little issues like there's conflict of interest. And so what happens if I have conflict of interest in an issue, but should my constituency have to lose its vote on this issue just because I have a conflict, or can I pass off my proxy to them?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that was it is, I think, still a somewhat sticky situation in terms of considering. There's definitely differences of opinion on that one. And I don't remember all the cases at the moment, but there were quite a few complicated cases. What happens if you leave a meeting? What happens if you intentionally leave a meeting and come back? It's difficult.
Right, and I want to stress, too, we can continue to work on this, this section. All we're saying here is that we do not anticipate it being completed by the time of SOL, in addition to the fact that it's not necessary to seat the council. So we're recognizing the duration that this section is going to require, including probably any real quick, though, then I'll let Ken, including the fact that the work team that works on this, whether it be us or some new group that forms in taking our spot, they're going to have to really get up to speed on what that whole process was and understand all the issues before just starting the wheel all over again, So I think there's just quite a bit of time here. But the purpose is not to say we're not going to work on it. The purpose is simply to say it's just not going to be ready by SOL.
That's fine. I just was asking for the background on that thing.
Yeah. Ken?
Yeah. I'm sorry. I might have somewhere we were talking about conflict of interest. I can give you a couple of issues that I would have some concern with. First of all, I guess we would have to define exactly what a conflict of interest is, because any vote taken by a contracted party house on amendments which could affect members of that contracted party technically could be, there could be grounds for some sort of conflict of interest, and yet by definition, that's why they're there and that's why they're representative. In the case of a specific individual, let me give you an example, because I can remember examples when I was chairman of CORE and we were talking about expanding namespace and stuff like that, and there was a lot of pressure for me to not vote on the issue. And in the case of the registry constituency, all of the votes that are given by the representatives of the registry constituency are in fact mandated to the representative by the constituency. So, in effect, the representative is casting a vote on behalf of the constituency in which he has a limited amount of discretion in which he can act, you know. I mean, so I'm thinking that it's very hard to call somebody out for a conflict of interest as an individual when the bylaws of the constituency specifically mandate that the votes that are taken by members of the council are directed votes.
Right. So Ken, are you agreeing that, you know, this is a complicated issue? And
I am, and I think it's going to get more complicated and will continue to remain that way, because in the case of the registrar's constituency, unless they've changed their bylaws, the registrars could vote as they wished, and that was why in many cases Bruce Tonkin recused himself, because he had freedom to vote as he wished.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's something we really need to get a little more direction on.
Yeah, I agree, and I think we're going to, as a work team, the members of the work team, like I said, us or future members, are really going to have to get up to speed on the 18 months worth of work that was already done and understand why, it would, after all that work was done, quite a bit, I guess, why then it wasn't even approved by the legal counsel of ICANN. I don't know the details of that, but we would have to become very familiar with that. So that's the reason why, practically speaking, we really can't, can't deliver this by soul, so we should say that. And then secondly, with the thought that it's not necessary anyway to seat the council. If it was necessary to seat the council, that would be different, but it isn't. So we're just noting that. And then
it's really a dicey situation for the chair and the co-chair. It's a matter of agenda management as well, because I think we have to be very, very careful. We have to make sure that we have a set of rules in place that assures that any critical votes that are needed can be taken.
Yeah.
If not, we need to identify that situation early enough on so we don't put the council in a box. Here they are being pushed to vote on an issue that really isn't yet covered in terms of how the actions can be taken. And I think, you know, we just need to be very careful. We all end up looking a bit silly. And,
okay. Makes sense. So
I'd like to point out that we've only talked about the conflict of interest issue, which is really a different issue than proxy voting, and an issue that needs to be resolved in its own right to actually define what conflict of interest is, which is incredibly hard.
Yeah.
And there's other sub-issues in this whole proxy thing. So.
Yeah,
and the proxy votes can get crazy, because I remember situations where people assigned proxy votes and they had directed proxy votes, and, you know,
that's why we're going to punt this one for now.
A mess on its own, you know.
That's why we're going to punt this one for now.
I think we need to.
Yeah, so my question is it okay that if we go ahead and collapse five, reading that sentence, maybe we adjust it later, maybe the OSC asked to adjust it slightly because I just quickly worded it, but we take 5.81 all the way through 5.86. And we put it underneath that, you know, we make sure that that sentence that we have there covers all those sections, not just 5.8.
Well, I should say in there, you know, please note this this note refers to sections and such.
Yeah,
right,
that's
right at the top.
Yeah, that's what we got to.
Why would we leave the rest of 5.8 in if it's not been discussed yet?
Well, the only one that's left is 5.88 absences. 5.8.
Oh, okay. So all of 5.8.
Yeah.
1 and 2 and 3. And,
yeah.
And those are gone. Oh,
yeah.
I see.
All
okay.
Those would fall under the umbrella of this note. That
okay.
We're...
Sorry. I was still seeing them. So.
Oh, that's okay. That's why we wanted to clarify that.
Ray, this Ray. Is really, I just have a quick question. Are you saying then we would just delete all of that text? I'm only concerned because essentially my understanding with this document is that anything that we are not changing stays as is and is retained.
Yep, I delete it. So, yes, that's what I'm suggesting. It is being deleted.
Because proxy voting is no longer being done.
Yeah.
So there will be no, right now there's no proxy.
Nope, system. There is no.
No, we're working on it.
Thank you. Just wanted to clarify. Thank you.
Right. It was ruled out of order several years ago by legal, and we have absentee vote now for serious things, but no.
Well, if that's the case, if general counsel has taken it out completely, why don't we ask Julie if she can go back and talk to JJ and find out if, in fact, you know, do we have to have proxies in there or not?
I think that is actually the high threshold question that falls under this work team. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't think we're prepared to say no, yes or no. It shouldn't be. We're just right now making a placeholder that says, you know, all we know today is that it won't be ready by Seoul.
And there are no current.
Yeah.
Proxy voting.
Yeah. That's what makes it not being urgent to seat the council. Because if the council is operating now without proxies, then. Certainly, they can see a new council without proxies.
Ray.
Yeah.
For one minute, get the list of the real hard issues here from Ken and Avery. I've got directed votes versus undirected votes, conflicts of interest. What else are the things that we actually have to identify the answer?
I think to be honest, I think we have to. We can delve into that. This is an area that we will work on as a work team. But today we have. Some other deadlines we have to get to here, some other sections. What we want to do today is simply agree upon the fact that this is not something we can complete in time for Seoul. Get that language in there, talk about what sections it's covering, and then let's defer this entire discussion on proxies to when we have the time to do that. That's what I'm asking the work team if we can do that now. Any objections?
I'm okay with that.
I am as well.
Okay. All right. But I would like to spend just quickly on 5.88. I don't see any reason to take that out.
I must admit I've never done it. There's lots of people I would have had to do it for. Although I guess in general, I mean, I have. If I haven't seen anybody around in a while, I do.
Yeah.
Send them an email and ask what's up, but nothing. Certainly, haven't ever done anything formal in.
Yeah. So
well,
I mean,
the key here, if I may, Chair, is it speaks about without notification of absence. So I think it's important we keep that in. So basically, what we're doing is telling these individuals that are on the council they need to be keeping in touch with their chair.
Yeah, pings are always a good idea.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so this 5.88 is going to be hanging out there all by itself then if we decide just to leave it as is, change the constituency to stakeholder group. We have 5.8, we have our note, we have the sections the note pertains to, and then 5.88, absences.
Ray, why don't you call it 5.9?
That's where I was going to go.
Well, Ray, this is Julie, though. We've deleted 5.8, 5.81 through 5.86, and we've also deleted 5.87 previously. That was disputes.
Yeah.
Right now there's no 5.8, which if that follows, then this would become 5.8 absences.
Well, no, I think 5.8 proxies stays, right?
But there's no text that we're retaining under it.
At this point, we'll put text in there at some point.
Well, the...
Respecting eligibility, notification.
Well, 5.8 heading is proxies. Underneath that, I would say for... sections. All right.
If I understand, though, what you're saying is for political reasons, so that people don't go ballistic that there's nothing on proxies, you're keeping a 5.8 null section that says proxies, this issue is still under consideration, or some words like that.
Yeah.
This issue is still under consideration, and this is just a placeholder for a policy that may or may not be created in the future.
Yeah, that's even better outreach.
And that keeps the political issue of, oh, my God, aren't you guys working on proxies?
Yeah.
We want proxies.
Yeah, that's even better. So you would just go ahead and delete 5.81. You don't have to refer to those sections.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Aubrey. Good thinking. I like that.
Okay, this is Julie. I've noted that. That would mean that absences would become 5.9.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
That works for me. Good.
Yeah, I'm good with that.
Okay. Okay, so now I think we get into the stickier sections. I suggest we go up to 4.1, which is the mathematician one.
Ella, can you get that call for me, please? Stay on my line.
Okay, so all right, so this is the issue where we wanted to define, you know, what does it mean to be in a leadership in a vote. Now, I threw out an idea, so let's just walk through this idea real quick. And we could sort of get around the complexity of this voting, which is being caused by a bylaws requirement of 60% threshold to vote in a chair or vice chair by simply requiring each house to nominate a single candidate. That will take care of 80% of the complexity here. So that is an idea that I have, and I think it makes sense to me. I don't know why, but it does. And what we're doing is we're putting the autonomy onto each house, which I think Rob even made a point that I didn't understand quite as well as I do now in a previous call, where there really hasn't been a lot of discussion on how the houses, each house, will go about their methods, if you will. But what we would be saying here is each house is allowed to nominate one candidate, and we're not going to speak to how it is they go about nominating that candidate. It's up to them. But each gets, can do one. And then that would take care of the complexity. Any thoughts?
I'm just trying to understand where does this new language go? We are on section 4.1.
4.1, so we have an A that says the GNSO chair shall be elected by 60% vote of both houses.
Right,
okay?
Right.
And then B would say each house will be allowed one candidate for GNSO council chair or vice chair, I guess.
So then you should say each house should self-organize to determine one candidate, or some language to that effect?
Right, through some procedure to be defined by the House itself.
Yeah.
It's kind of like almost a standard phrase.
That's it.
If I can bring up, I don't personally see an issue with it. One thing that is at variance, but I think that this was a false sense that was going to happen anyhow. The notion had been that the houses were really not things in themselves that had policies and procedures. They were just organizational counting entities. But then I think that was already broken by saying they each elected a vice chair. So while in principle this is sort of against the notion that houses don't exist as things in themselves, they're only counting conveniences,
mm-hmm.
to actually giving them yet another role. However, I think, as I said, by having them elect a vice chair, they've already been given that other role. That makes sense?
Yes. Yeah, it's a very good point.
It makes a certain kind of sense, and so they can have elections. They can have 17 candidates in each house and figure out how to get to one, and that's their problem.
Right.
I
like it as of today. I like that approach as of today. Now, we might hear later that what the first point you made, Aubrey, that these houses are... Wait a minute, you're assuming these houses exist as entities with that kind of language,
yeah.
And they don't. So you guys got to fix that.
And then you'll be able to respond, hey, you already gave them the job of electing a vice chair.
Yeah. So as of today, I do like the approach. What do others feel?
see some of the houses doing it by trial by combat. But
yeah. Anybody else have a strong feeling on this one?
Not me.
Right. Now, how would you terminate the process? You still have two, and so you still could end up having them tied.
Yeah.
House A votes for A, and House B votes for B. And your non-voting person can't vote. So then what do? I want mine. You know, why? If I do it from a house, and we've worked really hard to get our candidate, then why am I going to shift votes to your house?
Yeah, you have an example in here where it equals 100%, then something happens. Here it is, number two.
Right, yeah, basically, if we stay even, then we punt and try again in a couple months.
That's it.
Okay. I just wanted to, okay.
And I think the language in here, how we can incorporate it, that has to do with none of the above.
Yeah, and I can see the political motion on that. My candidate didn't win in my house, therefore I'm going to vote for your candidate. So, yeah, I can see the political mechanisms that would make it possibly work.
Yeah. Okay. And I think we should retain none of the above.
Yes, I agree with that.
Okay. So, all right. So now, with all that said, how do we reword this? I suggest the idea we put in the new B under A, which says each house will be allowed one candidate for GNSO council chair and vice chair. Is that right? And vice chair? Or are we just talking, A is just GNSO council. All right, the heading of this is the GNSO council shall select the GNSO chair and two vice chairs as follows. We don't speak to, does the vice chair require a 60% vote of both houses?
No. The vice chair is elected purely by the house.
Okay.
Again, I don't know. I think it may require 60% of that house. I'd have to check bylaws. I think so.
Okay. All right, so we don't have to worry about the vice chair.
But that's just a single house thing.
Okay, gotcha. All right, so then B is just each house will be allowed one candidate for GNSO council chair.
Do we want to note in there that that could be a non-com appointee as well?
Oh, yeah. Then if we want to be perfectly clear, and maybe Ken can weigh in on this one, because I think he understands really the nominating committee, ICANN board nominating committee stuff real well. But we, as I said in an email, we had a discussion on the same kind of thing when it came to who could we elect as our non-com rep. And we can nominate anybody for that. So somewhere it says that in the affirmative. Ken brought it out in a registry constituency meeting, I remember. So somewhere it says that, you know.
That's correct.
So we could take that same tact here and actually come out and say it, so in the future somebody could say, yeah, it says right there that a chair does not need to be a member of a stakeholder group or a house or however it is we want to say it. Do we want to say that in the affirmative?
Well, there's only one person that's not in a stakeholder or a house.
Oh, no. There's billions of people.
Be anybody from
the
world.
Billions of people, right.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I won't comment then.
I don't see any reason why not. Let's put it this way. If the community is feels so strongly about it that they're voting him in at 60% from both houses, then that says to me that individual has the standing to do the job. So
I agree.
I don't see any reason why we should, I think we should keep it open and allow, and that would then allow for NCAs as well as anybody else. So I think we can say that they're entitled to elect whomever they wish.
Yeah, now, Ken, are you on the call? All right.
Ken has dropped off. He's disconnected.
I really wanted to get Ken's opinion on whether that could work at a council level, because as we know, it does work on the ICANN board nominating game. I wanted to get some contrast or difference, but he's not there. So in lieu of that...
no bylaw that would prevent it.
There's no bylaw, right? It makes common sense to me that there really shouldn't be anything to prevent it. You want the best person. However, at the end of the day, it comes down to that.
You probably have to add something specific that, said that should a chair be elected from outside the houses, this would be a non-voting chair, obviously.
Yeah.
And that's because we do say somewhere that if they're elected from their house, well, actually, that was in the if they're elected from a house, they retain their vote.
Yeah, yeah. So that would.
And if they're elected from if a non-house person is elected, whether it's NCA or whatever, it will be a non-voting position.
Ray, this is Julie. I have been noting this discussion. I have some language based on what we've discussed that I could suggest if you'd like.
Yes, please.
So we have A, and following A, we have a new B. B would read, each house will be allowed one candidate for GNSO Council Chair, period. Candidate for GNSO Council Chair does not need to be a member of a house. Should a chair be elected outside the houses, the chair will be a non-voting chair.
Sorry, I didn't catch the last one.
The last sentence would read, should a chair be elected outside the houses, the chair will be a non-voting chair.
You know, the only issue I have with that, is it really takes away the incentive of that house to put forth such a candidate, and they're losing a vote.
How would they lose a vote?
909. Hey, that's our anniversary.
Because if they're elected from the House, if they're a member of the House and are the chair, they get to retain their vote.
Right.
But if they're not a member of the House, then they lose the vote.
No.
No?
They still have all their votes.
Oh, okay.
It's just that that chair, either a non-voting member of council or a non-member of council, has no vote. You just want to be explicit about it.
Okay.
Getting elected chair doesn't automatically give you a vote somehow.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
I have a question also to B. You know, each I understand the candidates already have to get the 60% vote. Is that correct? You know, within their houses.
Oh well, with that, I don't. We're not. If I'm understanding it correctly, we're not going there, Wolf.
Aha. Uh-huh. So
they're not going there.
Candidate only needs a majority.
Well, we're not going there. That's up to the House.
Yeah, okay, but you know that means that the houses need some rules. So could there be different rules for each house?
I think so. As of today,
just like there are different ones for stakeholder groups.
That was the issue I was raising in the proxy discussion. We have a lot of different rules underneath the covers.
Yeah. So I think what we are doing is we are allowing the houses to be autonomous. Now the issue is, as Aubrey pointed out, is we're creating allowing them to be autonomous. They're not even entities. So, but as of today, it makes sense to me to take the position where we're allowing the houses to be autonomous, to decide for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Huh?
And all we're doing now is we're clarifying that, you know, you don't have to be a member of the House or the stakeholder group to be a chair. We just want to state that in the affirmative.
Okay.
So, Julie, can you read that last sentence, the last point? I think it's C, again?
Well, actually, I had put all of this in.
Okay.
But I could relabel them each as A.
No, yeah.
But anyway, the last one was, should a chair be elected outside the houses, that chair will be a non-voting chair. And that may not, there might be a more elegant way to word that, of course.
Yeah. Does anybody have a problem with Julie working on more elegantly stating that? Or?
Ray, this is Julie. I'd probably be inclined to leave it as is. If you guys, though, have some other ways that you would like me to rephrase it, that would be great.
Okay. Leave it as is, and then as a work team, let's look at it. Just bring it maybe to Rob's attention, and if he wants to offer a suggestion of how to word it on the email list, please invite him to do that.
Sure. He'll see it nonetheless as it goes to the list.
Right. Okay. So are we good with that now? All right. So Julia's captured it up to that point. Now there is the issue of 3-2, which says what happens when there's a tie, and we say that, so I think what we can say now in the instance when neither candidate achieves 60% of the vote, the election will be rescheduled for no sooner than the minimum election interval, which shall be defined as 30 days. Is that correct?
This is Julie Ray. I thought I heard you say that you wanted to keep the none of the above option. Is that now off the table?
No. Oh, yeah. No, we want to keep the none of the above option.
Because then number 3 would be in case neither candidate reaches 60% of both houses threshold.
Oh, okay, good.
Ballot, you know, et cetera, none of the above.
Yeah, okay. So then does everything under that go away? In other words, beginning with in case there are 3 or more candidates, everything underneath that, does that go away?
Yeah, that's very, very cumbersome.
Yeah, so I think everything beginning with 3, because we've eliminated the possibility of there being 3 or more candidates, it can now just, for simplicity, go away. All the way up to the sentence that reads, each house shall elect a vice chair via 60% vote within each house.
Right, this is Julie. Let me clarify. But we would be taking out the you know, mathematical,
yep,
language, which makes sense. But we retain 3 in case neither candidate reaches the 60% of both houses threshold, et cetera. And number 4, if the single candidate does not reach 60% of both houses, then the election will be rescheduled. Is that correct?
Sorry, so you're saying number 4 might stay?
Item 4, right?
Item 4.
Item 4 and item 3, because item 3, you know, talks about the ballot between the leader and none of the above. And then if a leader cannot be determined, then the election is rescheduled. If the single candidate does, and then item four is, if the single candidate does not reach the 60%, then the election will be rescheduled for no sooner than the minimum election time, which will be defined as 30 days. So I'm asking, do we retain 3 and 4? And 2. So items 2, 3, and 4, that is in small case Roman numerals.
Well, 3 right now is the formula.
Yeah,
that, right? I mean, that's why we're confused. We're looking at 3 right now, and that's that long formula.
Yeah.
So I think, Julie, let me try this. So you're saying we're going to keep item 1, item 2, item 3 now becomes this new text, correct? So we just discussed that item 4 remains the same in case neither of the candidates reach 60, and then item 5 in a single candidate does not reach. So what I'm saying is item 4 and item 5 would stay. What we've done is replaced item 3.
But
I don't know if that item 4 is needed, Ron.
Do we know how to figure out who's in the lead between the two candidates? I mean, I think we do, but do we? Is it written? Does it need to be written? I mean, I think it's easy. You add up the percentages, and the highest percentages.
Do I have an appointment?
Well, okay.
And since you've got the one from each house, you've no longer got that historical, you know, problem.
Well, in order to win, though, a candidate has to have 60%. And if they don't reach that threshold, it has to be a redo.
Right, but what do you do? Do you redo between the two, or do you do an election between the leader and none of the above?
Oh, not the latter one. I hear you. Okay.
Because starting with 2 doesn't get you to a decision without, and what do you do if you have the 2 and you have one of them, their percentages add up to 110, and the other one, their percentages add up to 90? So one isn't leading, but still they don't add up to, you know, 120, 60 from each house. So you can't declare that person winner because they haven't met the 60 threshold, rerunning the election again against the two of them doesn't really make sense. Saying that we punt on it for several months because they're tied doesn't make sense. So you still have to have a step that resolves it.
Right.
Now, if you have the leader run against none of the above, so then the other house has a chance to say, well, you know, my guy didn't make it, and but this one's okay, I'll vote for him as opposed to none of the above, then that person gets the 60%. Or they say, absolutely not, no way in the world would I want her to be chair, and therefore none of the above gets the 90%, and thus, you know, then you're in the deadlock. Because none of the above is one, okay, fine, then we're in the punting situation. But you still have to have some way to bring the decision procedure to a close. So by doing it the way you've done it, you've certainly eliminated the first complexity step of, you know, moving from N candidates to two candidates.
Okay. Yeah, I see your point, Aubrey. It's a good one. So we still have to deal with this issue of how do we define the leader. I commonsensically, I kind of thinking like you are, Aubrey, that you'll do it by percentages. So if it's not equal, in other words, one percentage is higher than the other, then it would go to that candidate versus the none of the above. And if by chance none of the above prevails, then you're all the way back to square one.
Yeah, then you need the whole new candidate list, and you start the whole thing again.
All over again. Yeah. Okay. So with it saying it, reasoning it out that way, what in here now can stay? What in here now addresses that?
You have to rewrite three for a simpler. The leading candidate shall be determined as following.
Using yeah.
Add the percentages they receive from each house together. The larger is the leading candidate.
Yeah, yeah. The leading candidate shall be defined as the one with the highest percentage.
Highest total percentage when you add the two. Yeah.
Yeah, with the highest total percentage.
As I say, I'm not quite sure how to say it in words. It's really easy to say it in that. But I'm sure, Julie, you know, go ahead.
Okay, so...
I'm sorry, Julie.
So the new three would say something to the effect of the leading candidate shall be determined as the one with the highest total percentage of votes from each house. Or from both houses. Then we would have to go to a next one, a numerate four.
Yeah, that one's essentially the same, except to change the word third to second.
Yeah. Okay. What does that second part of that sentence mean, though? If a leader, can we get rid of a leader? If a leader cannot be determined, I don't think we need that anymore, do we?
No, not if we're going to define what a leader is.
Right. We can get rid of the latter half of that
right.
sentence.
Yeah, it depends how one and two are written.
Yeah. Now we have this numerate five, which is if the single candidate does not reach the 60% of houses, election will be scheduled. That's when you go all the way back to square one, right?
Yep.
So in the second ballot, if the single candidate does not reach the 60% of both houses, that refers to the second ballot.
Correct.
Maybe we should say that. In the second ballot. Julie, are you catching these edits?
Yeah, Ray, I am. Yeah. When we think we're final, I won't read all the words, but I'll just run by what I have. And of course, you'll all be able to review that when I send it out after this call as well.
Someone summarize then just kind of where we are with this thing now?
Ray, this is Julie. Maybe I'll summarize what I've heard and maybe
yeah. Let
me know if I've missed something. Okay, so we retained, under the statement, the GNSO Council shall select the GNSO chair and two vice chairs as follows. We have A, which we've retained. The GNSO chair shall be elected by 60% vote of both houses. And we have a new B. Each house will be allowed one candidate for GNSO Council chair. A candidate for GNSO Council chair does not need to be a member of a house. Should a chair be elected outside the houses, that chair will be a non-voting chair. Under that, we have item in lowercase Roman numeral 1, all ballots will include the none of the above option. In the event that this option gets 60% of both houses, the election will be rescheduled for no sooner than the minimum election interval, which shall be defined as 30 days. Does that stay in?
Yes.
I don't know if we talked about it.
That stands.
Okay. The next item is lowercase Roman numeral 2. The leading candidate will be defined as the one with the highest total percentage of votes from both houses. Correct?
Correct.
No, it doesn't number 2 remain the same in case there are three or more candidates?
No, because we're down to 2.
No, because we've eliminated the possibility of there being 3 candidates.
Oh, okay.
But do you have the paragraph in there? Yeah, you did have the paragraph in there about each child.
So I'm sorry.
Candidate.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Next, we have lowercase Roman numeral 3. In the second ballot, in case neither candidate reaches the 60% of both houses threshold, a third ballot will be held between the leader and none of the above.
No.
And then you have lowercase Roman numeral 4. If the single candidate does not reach the 60% of both houses threshold, then the election will be rescheduled for no sooner than the minimum election interval, which shall be defined as 30 days.
I think that's correct.
I think I got confused because I didn't think so. If we can go through again, the first one said, the little I said the none of the above option.
Correct.
Little 2 said there will be 2 candidates, 1 selected from each house, or was that somewhere else?
That was actually
in the top.
That's B. Each house will be allowed 1 candidate.
Okay.
Chair.
So then the second one defined leader.
That's correct.
Which was fine. Then the third one, you talked about a third ballot, but it's really a second ballot.
Yeah, that's right.
That's correct. Ballot. We say in the second ballot, if each neither candidate reaches the 60% of both houses threshold, a third ballot will be held between the leader and none of the above.
Oh, okay, sorry. Okay, thanks. I misunderstood.
Oh, no problem. There's a lot here to process.
Okay.
And then lowercase 4 was the single candidate does not reach the 60%.
Thanks, I apologize.
Go back to the beginning. And then following this is item C, which was there before. Each house shall select a vice chair via 60% vote within each house, and we do not define what that should be.
Can I ask for clarification on that one? Each house will select a vice chair via 60%. Within each house might be ambiguous. Within that house?
Within their respective house?
Right, something like that, yeah.
Within their respective house. Each house
right.
will select vice chair, within their respective house.
Yeah, thanks, because I was just saying within that, each house could be seen ambiguously.
Mm-hmm.
This is Julie. I've noted that.
All right, so this is an area where we are telling the houses how to do it. We're
telling them what the threshold is.
We're dictating a threshold.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, they can do it by consensus because that's 60%.
But maybe we need to use some language here to say each house shall self each
because
house.
I think that one is in bylaws.
Oh, it is?
I think the 60% is in. I have to go back and check.
Okay.
I know I've said things.
This is Julie Aubrey. You're correct. It is in the bylaws.
Right.
Okay.
So we're really just repeating the bylaws there.
Okay. Okay. So
the following paragraph fits in line with that. Then each house shall select 60% vote in each house. And the following line, chair and vice chair may not be selected from the same stakeholder group.
Yeah.
The chair or vice chair shall retain his or her vote in their respective house rather than his/her again.
Right. Now, with the sentence beginning, a chair and vice chair may not be elected from the same stakeholder group. Should that So that I noticed the one above, each house shall select a vice chair via 60%, is a C.
Right.
So should the next one be a D?
I'm thinking that, and I think the following one should be an E.
Okay.
Those two sentences in that paragraph.
Okay.
So basically, if just to be clear then, so C and then D is a chair and vice chair may not be elected from the same stakeholder group, and E is the chair or vice chair shall retain his or her vote in the respective house. And we come to the pink station. Wolf Ulrich, this is your section you have questions on, I think.
The one that begins in the event that the Genocidal Council?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, well, that was my...
Okay.
I think we discussed it last time, so...
Okay, we addressed it last time?
Yes, we addressed it already last time, so that's for me no problem anymore.
Okay, now with that said, I think we are prepared to move on from 4.1.
The only thing there is I'm just wondering if we need to, just from a formatting point of view, if this is going to continue F and G, because those are different elements of the same thing.
F and G, where are you?
I'm just saying, that these last paragraphs, you know, we added a D and an E, and then we have Wolf's paragraph in the pink. In the event it's not selected Genocidal Council, maybe that should be F, and and then the sentence below that would probably be G.
Okay.
Ron, actually, I have this incorrectly. This is Julie.
Yeah.
I have each house shall select a vice chair via 60% vote within their respective houses. That is C.
Right.
Following that, I have D. A chair and vice chair may not be elected from the same stakeholder group.
Correct.
The chair or vice chair shall retain.
No. Then the next sentence becomes E. The chair or vice chair shall retain.
You're saying you're adding yet another one. Okay.
That's it.
And then F would be in the event that the Genocidal Council has not elected a council chair by the end, et cetera.
Right. And then the council shall inform the board and community appropriately after election results. That can be, I don't know if that should be lettered or not, but certainly the paragraphs preceding.
Yeah, I think that should be G.
Oh, yes. Well, it's Will speaking. My very last question for this pink sentence. So there was only the question with regards to the minimum the minimum election interval. Does it fit, you know, with the last sentence of that paragraph? Each follow-up council meeting shall be used to conduct a successful council chair election. On the other hand, we have, I think, introduced this minimum election interval. This should that should comply with that sentence. Or this sentence should be replaced, you know, by the minimum election interval, isn't
well,
it?
Well, no. You could say, to conduct successful, each follow-up council meeting shall be used. I see what you're saying. So we've said before it had to be 30 days.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
So you're saying rather than each follow-up council meeting shall be used, we should say within the 30-day period or subsequent to whatever that section is, looks like a B, small v, the section B, I guess, 4B, 4.1B. We'll check that, Julie. But basically it'll say here, in pursuant to section 4.1B, 4.1B, the standard 30-day period will follow in order to complete a successful chair election or something like that. Because I agree with you, Wolf, this what it says right now doesn't make sense. We've said it's a 30-day period, and we didn't say each follow-up, not each meeting thereafter.
Yeah.
Do you even need to say it again? How about if you just don't say, just be silent there? We're already clear above.
In the event the Genocidal Council is not elected chair, by the end of the vice chairs will serve as interim until we can be held. Yeah, that's fine. Exactly. Until a successful election can be held. We've said it. So let's just cancel that second sentence.
Yeah.
Okay. Good catch.
Well, I've noted it.
Okay. Anybody else on section 4.1? All right. So let's move on to 16. Right? I think that's... All right, well, 16. 16 is absentee voting. Okay, so as I was looking at this morning, I looked at it and said, you know, we're conflicting with the bylaws here because the bylaws identify when specifically absentee voting can be used, and then we have a 16.2 that says, you know, absentee ballots for all other things. I don't think we can do that. I know we talked about this last week, too, and the more I thought about it, I don't think we can do that.
Yeah.
So what we're trying to do is accommodate for the practical need that we know there is for email voting. We know that there is that. We can't take that away. It's being done now. So the trick here, I think, is to identify how we can do email voting, but make sure it's not considered as absentee voting. So one way is let's just take email vote. Well, other than the one reference to email as one of the ways absentee balloting can be done, let's just take email voting and make it its own section, a new section 17. So I think Julie did that, right? Yeah. And just as a placeholder, we've called it email voting. So the idea here is to try and come up with a set of criteria that can accommodate email voting, but not be considered as absentee voting. So, okay, so what am I saying? So I think with... I think that 16.1 can just remain the way it is. Well, there is. I do have a little nit in there that says, you know, there's a little italicized, amend Article 10 of the bylaws. And then I have a question there, and I think Wolf does too, I guess. You know, what is this for? What is that? I don't understand that.
It's Wolf speaking. So the one is, okay, Article 6, you know, it's referring to the council itself, to the organization of the council, and et cetera, et cetera. So my impression was that here in the list for absentee balloting, the issues which are here in the list are of high importance, I would say. And so I would say, okay, also something which refers to the organization of the council itself, of the group who is balloting right now, so it's very important to that group. So that's the reason why I put it in.
Oh, you put in the italicized amendment?
Well, you know, that was, you know, during the public comment period of the bylaws.
Oh.
So it used to be in the bylaws. And there was a comment done from us, from the ISPCP, with regards to that. And that was the outcome of that we put it in. So, and then it was decided, okay, to remove it from the bylaws, to remove it only. So, and then the question was, yeah, where to put it in then? And the only location we found is here in the Rules of Procedures. That's the reason. That was a proposal from the ISPCP. So, okay, it's still open for discussion whether you could agree to that or not.
I'm just trying to make sense of the sentence as it is written right now.
Right. This is Julie. May I make a suggestion?
Yeah.
So I think what we're saying here is that, you know, there are several, you know, the list of items under which, you know, an absentee ballot may occur. So members that are absent from a meeting at the time of vote on a vote, and maybe we want to lay these out a little bit more clearly, but absent from a meeting at a time of vote on, one, whether to initiate a PDP, two, follow a policy recommendation to the board, three, amend Article 10 of the bylaws, or four, fill a position open for election, may vote by absentee ballot. That was the way I understood it.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah, I like that approach. Go ahead and identify the four specifics.
Yeah. So last time from our last discussion, I understood from Avri that the reason why it used to be a list here of items or issues, it was because it was in former times it was in the bylaws, and then it was there may have been a discussion with the general counsel about what is, let me say, what kind of issues are are of that high priority that they could be placed on bylaw level. So now, if you take that into consideration, now as the absentee balloting is removed from the bylaws to a lower level, let me say, in legal aspects. So the question should be discussed, you know, whether this list is complete or there may be other issues as well put into. But there was no other proposal, not yet. You know, did you understand what I mean?
Yes. Yes. And I think I am a little confused too. So these four things that Julie just said, 1 through 4,
yeah,
they used to be in, they were in the bylaws, now they're not.
The three things before.
Three things before. Now they're not in the bylaws at all.
Yes.
So the question is, do we want to restate them here?
Do we want to restate it? Do we want to limit it?
Yeah, do we want to limit it? That's the question.
Yeah. The question is, do we want to limit it, the absentee balloting?
Well, we do have three identified right now.
No, it's four. With the amendment of the Article X.
Oh, Mark amendment of Article X.
It's four as well.
Four.
Well, my opinion is, well, we should really limit it. So because otherwise, then, no absentee balloting is maybe used in not in a proper way, I would say, you know. At first, I would say, okay, council meetings are meetings where people should be present. They should be present, really, you know, and they shouldn't have that's the highest priority. And absentee balloting only in cases if there is really a case that they could be present at the time of voting. So therefore, it should be really limited. That's my opinion.
So up in 16.1, oh, never mind. I mean, I don't want to confuse things more. So we're saying in 16.1, the very first sentence, the items are initiate PDP, forward a policy recommendation to the board, amend the bylaws anyway.
Or fill a position.
Right. Or fill a position for election. Which bylaws are they referring to? ICANN bylaws?
Yes, ICANN bylaws dealing with council.
Oh.
Yeah, Ray, this is Julie. I should have put in ICANN bylaws. Article, the reason it's a weighty matter to be, you know, considered under absentee ballot is because amending Article 10 of the ICANN bylaws is amending the operation of the GNSO Council.
All right, so we want to say Article 10 in this. So, because up above in 16.1, it just says amend the ICANN bylaws, basically. But we want, if we're going to say this, then we do want to say Article 10 of the ICANN bylaws.
Mm-hmm.
This is Julie. I've put that in.
Okay, now I understand the sentence, the next sentence. A little slow.
Can I want one thing on that? I have two questions. One is, all the GNSO can ever do is not amend the bylaws, but recommend an amendment to the bylaws.
Exactly.
So you probably want to do that because the GNSO can't amend them.
Yes.
And two, that being the case, should it be for, I mean, because it could be for amending the appendices dealing with PDPs. So does it need to be any specific change in the bylaws that the GNSO would recommend, or could it just be for a GNSO recommendation of an amendment to the bylaws?
Well, let me think about this.
Does it need to be specific? I'm just asking.
Yeah, no, it's a good question, and I kind of side on the latter. Well, you wouldn't be so specific. If you're going to say, you know, recommend Article 10, then, like you said, why not the PDP section? But if you don't mind, let me just ask a question. That is, why would the GNSO Council be doing this, making a recommendation of a change to the bylaws?
We do it. We've done it several times. We certainly did it when we requested the proxy and the absentee. We may do it on changing the rules under which a PDP. We certainly did it when it came time to suggest bylaw changes for the restructuring and so-called improvements. You know, the GNSO can ask for a change to the bylaws anytime it feels like it, kind of. That doesn't mean they have to get it,
mm-hmm.
but you know, requesting a change to the bylaws is a normal thing for an AC or an SO to do. It's the board that decides and disposes, but certainly the GNSO can request.
Mm-hmm.
And it did. The reason there is absentee ballots is because we asked for proxy and, you know, negotiated and eventually got that.
Mm-hmm.
So, that, you know, any number of reasons I could think of.
Okay.
As I say, it's just a request and a recommendation. It doesn't carry any, you know, forceful weight on the board other than, obviously, if something comes bottom up and they don't do it, well,
yeah.
Then they have to deal with not doing it. But it has, I'm losing the right word, but it doesn't force them to do anything.
Okay. Now, we may get a council legal opinion on that later. But for now, for sake of argument, I guess we can make that assumption now, that it's just a request. It can't force the board to do something they don't want to do. It stands to reason.
Ray, this is Julie. Well, I've picked up the language that Avery gave.
Yeah.
Recommendation of amendments to the ICANN bylaws. So we're not saying here that has to be accepted. We're simply saying that if there is, you know, that one of the items on which there would be an absentee ballot is recommendation of amendments to the ICANN bylaws.
Right. Okay. Good point. I'm comfortable with that. So that's 16. That's set in 16.1. And does that take care of the first sentence in the next paragraph too? I mean, we're choosing here to name these four things, right? That's what I'm hearing. That we want to name these four things.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, now I understand. So that said, is there any other changes to this paragraph? Okay, if not, then we can move on to 16.2.
Actually, Ray, this is Julie. I think I should have taken that out since that's referring to what now is a separate section.
Okay.
Email voting.
Yeah.
In which case it would go on from the paragraph that says the GNSO Secretariat will provide reasonable means of transmitting and authenticating absentee ballots. And then the next sentence would be, for all other votes at the discretion of the GNSO Council Chair, an absentee ballot via email can be held. I don't know if we need to keep that in. The following rules will apply, because that, again, that was pulled into a new Section 17.
Okay, I
would delete those. Delete 16.2.
This is Julie. That's my sense as well.
Yeah. 16.2, but Julie, then 16.2.1, 2.2, 2.3, all would go? Is that somewhere else?
That's a good question. This is Julie. Now that, and I think I should have picked this up this morning. So This would then follow into the email voting section and should not appear here. Is that?
I think so, yeah.
That's what I'm thinking, yeah.
But then what? Let me ask about 16.2.4 as it stands here. Actual meetings are required for other matters. And then we had a question mark where NC, and I was not able to determine what NC stood for. That's what it was in the original without any definition.
Names counselors.
Names counselors, probably.
I see.
Yeah.
Members can speak to and hear one another for other council meetings to be valid, although email voting followed by confirmation works. Vote taken by email, therefore, have confirmed. Again, my sense is this would go into the email voting section.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely. Every 2.4, 2.5, it's all about email.
Yeah.
Okay, well then I will pull that up into email voting. And then in 17, Ray had added the language, if at the time of a vote there is a quorum but not a simple majority present from each house, at the discretion of the chair, a vote by email may be initiated. In such cases, all votes must be cast by email. And then I would put in that part that I just pulled out of Section 16, and then go on to email to the council list and then just give examples of the elements that should appear in each of those various email as opposed to giving templates.
Yep. One small amendment, a friendly amendment, is that sentence, if at the time of vote a quorum is not, the part that Ray added in there, there's a quotation mark at the end of initiated.
Oh, yeah.
End of the first sentence.
Right.
Yeah, actually, that was my mistake. I saw it already.
No problem.
Yeah, thanks.
Yep. Well, I agree with what you just said, and putting forward the elements makes more sense than the actual template. Much better.
Okay. And those elements work? Is it inclusive enough, I mean? Well...
Well, I wonder if it says the following type of elements. It should be the following elements. Take away, let's remove the word type of.
Yeah.
So the body of the email must include the following elements. That would both be for 17.1 and 17.2.
Right.
So this is Julie. So noted.
Okay, so... down below where it's 17.2, secretary sends a ballot to the requester. Upon receiving a request for a ballot, if this becomes an all or nothing situation, in other words, the chair uses his or her discretion and says, okay, you know, we have a quorum, we don't have simple majority. This is one of those things that I think we can and should do an email vote. Then the process starts. It won't be a situation where somebody has to ask for the ballot anymore. It's just going to go out. So there wouldn't be...
Then it should be, say, rather than upon receiving a request for a ballot, it should be upon determination by the chair that an email vote will be taken, and then it picks up the rest of the sentence.
And we've been doing that pretty much anyhow. It's just sort of, while the thing originally started as needing to request... I think lately there's just been an assumption that the request is here. Let's offer.
Yeah. So.
Yes, this is Glenn. It's exactly as it has been done. And Avery and Chuck have been very happy with that. And I think practically it works out better.
Okay.
So what would be the appropriate language there then, Glenn or Avery?
Something like once it's been determined.
Okay. So as I suggested, when determined by the chair that an email vote will be initiated, the GNSO secretariat sends ballots to all counselors.
All absent counselors.
Well, I think what Ray is saying, he'd like to say that if it comes down to an email vote, that everyone would send an email in. Is that correct, Chair?
Yeah, everybody would automatically on the council receive the email.
Why? That means we wouldn't vote ever.
No.
What's
anytime
that?
We decided it was an email vote because somebody was absent, we would always end up doing an email vote?
No. That, for whatever reason, there's a quorum, but not a simple majority. The chair decides to do an email vote. That initiates a process where the secretariat sends out the ballot to each member.
That's a lot of work for the secretariat, and I'm not sure why.
I don't fully understand the reason for sending out an email ballot to everybody when those people are on the call.
Because that's what distinguishes it from an absentee ballot. It's when someone is not on the call that you have to do the absentee.
Oh, I see. This is another kind of thing.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Okay.
Sorry.
I'm sorry.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, this is Julie. We've separated it into a separate section and separated it from absentee.
Okay, this is just, for some reason, we just don't feel there's enough people to hold the vote now. Maybe we had a quorum when we started, but then everybody ran off because the meeting ran long, and we still want to have the vote. So the chair says, okay, we'll do it by email.
Yeah.
Got it. Sorry, being stupid.
Okay. That can be a vote on anything then, am I understanding correctly?
On those four thingies.
Oh, on those four thingies, okay.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry.
That's still an absentee.
Oh, I
think that's on any vote.
On any vote this can be called, okay.
Yeah, it would almost be any vote but those four things.
Oh, okay.
Right. Everything but those four things.
Let's hope they're not going to use that too often.
If they do, you'll probably end up talking to Kent and getting some sort of easy procedure built for doing it.
Actually, there is a system out there built for doing it. That's
right. So, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so then if we go down to, I think we're down to 17.
Sorry, going just back to that again, talking about an easy system for doing it.
Yeah.
What would be the difference between an electronic vote and an email vote? Because we do have an electronic vote, for example, board directors and the council chair and those sort of things.
An electronic vote.
And that comes out of the system. The system is...
Yeah, that's only for absentee voting.
Electronic vote? No, the electronic vote is sent out by email.
And that's the one that has...
The absentee vote is sent out by email. It's not sent out by a voting system.
And that's the one that has the extra verification step.
Yes.
Okay, so what's the difference between an electronic vote and an email vote? The situation.
Now, basically, I'd say the way they've been used is the electronic vote is used for secret ballot. So voting for chair has been secret ballot. And voting for board seat has been secret ballot, and that's when the electronic's been used. The email ballot is a non-secret. Everybody, you know, that was there gave their ayes and nays verbally, and everyone that isn't there sends in their thingy, and anybody can see it. So it's non-secret. Now, this vote that you're proposing sounds like it would be a non-secret ballot.
Right. Good. I think that's the distinction then.
And you could use an electronic means other than the one we've got now for non-secret ballot, but that's beside the point. Means will change. And I'm going to have to leave to go to my next NSO teleconference.
That's right, yes.
Yes, unfortunately, I also have to drop off now. How much do we have left, Chair?
Well, with that said, we really did kind of get a lot through 16. How much do we have left? Really, not much. Not much. Now, we have a little bit of a hard, soft deadline here to get this thing over to the OSC Friday. So that means we need a clean version, we need a work, you know, we need the red line version, and we need the historical document version that we discussed, assuming we still do that. And that's Friday.
Well, we're going to work on it then via email in the next day or two.
Okay.
I don't see any reason why we can't, personally.
I don't think so either. So Julie, are you able to get the next Redline version out there? How soon are you? What do you think?
Ray, this is Julia. I can do that today. Note that there was one new item that we've not discussed, and we can perhaps deal with it quickly over email, and that is Section 18, Observers, was added because that was taken out of the bylaws and deliberately so that it would appear here in the operating procedures. So the language is simply excerpted from what had appeared in the bylaws and placed here. So what I'll do is I will do a redlined I'll do a redlined version of what we've discussed today. I might suggest for your consideration, Ray, that for the purpose of the Operations Steering Committee, so as not to give them lots of different documents to have to deal with, that I produce a non-redlined version that simply has stricken language, that is the language that we were taking out, non-stricken language, that is the original language, and language in red that is the language that we're adding so that they can see both the old and the new in one version. And I'm concerned about including redlining and comments because many of these things we've discussed and agreed to, and if I leave that in a redline version, I think it might be confusing for them.
Okay.
Yep, right. I agree.
Okay.
Just trying to keep things simple.
Yeah, that's what I'm shooting for. On the totally clean version, if you could, take all the ones that were referring to bylaws and put that into the opening, if you will, the opening of the document. These sections are now covered by the bylaws.
And then delete them?
Yes.
Well, you might leave them as headings, because that way, at least, you know, one can then see the headers, you know. So, you know.
Right, but there are, in many cases, there's a combination of both references to the bylaws and language that we've retained and language that we've stricken. So sections contain, some sections just have a reference to the bylaws, and some sections have a combination of both. So
yeah, I think, Chair, if I may, sorry, Julie, I think that as I'm scanning through these, I think it's fine just to leave the stricken piece in there, the red saying, see, I can't buy a law article, whatever, and so forth. It's clear.
Okay.
And, yeah. Again, there'll be a final clean document at one point where all the stricken stuff is gone.
Precisely, once the OSC has handled it, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay, let's just do that. I think they were expecting a clean document in addition to a redline document. But that's what we're saying.
She can serve up a clean one.
Yes.
As well as this red and stricken one.
Okay, fair enough.
That's the point.
The clean one would have references to the bylaws where they appear, and the reason I'm suggesting that is because in the final version, the final clean version that's approved, there will be live links to those sections of the bylaws, which will link to that language in an appendix to the document. That's just not here right now.
Okay. All right, that sounds like a good plan of action. I know people have a hard stop here. So let's proceed this way and have a continued discussion on list.
Great. I'll get that document out in the next couple hours.
Okay. Fair enough.
Thanks, Julie.
Yeah, thank you. With that said, I'd like to end the recording and adjourn the call.
Yeah.
And thank everybody for their time.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye for now.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you all, everyone.